Warning, this podcast may contain graphic violence, sexual themes, and bad language. If our language offends you, we apologize, but we do not give a fuck. Be mindful of your kids listening.
What's up, evil ones? How's it going, everybody? Hope you're having a great 4th of July weekend for those of you that live in the States. This week for episode 61, recently Carl and I were invited as guest hosts on the Tragedy of Cinema podcast. I want to give a shout out to Jimbo and Kyle for letting us do this crossover episode with them, and we're doing it on Friday the 13th, part one. So give them guys a listen. They cover a variety of films, and they do a good job covering them all. So enjoy, everybody, and again, have a good 4th of July weekend. And stay evil, everybody.
Hello? Who is that? Oh, hi. What are you doing out in this mess?
We were just messing up.
Four. Five. Six.
It must be my imagination.
Seven.
Can I help you? Hello?
Eight.
Hey guys, welcome to the Tragedy of Cinema podcast. I am your host, Jimbo, and today I'm joined by two of my friends and fellow podcasters from the Evil Never Dies podcast. I have Brett and Carl. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us on, Jimbo. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, definitely.
So in case you guys don't know, Carl and Brett host a podcast called The Evil Never Dies. Brett is a big Michael Myers fan, so I'm assuming that's where the name came from. But their podcast is about heavy metal music, rock music, horror movies, free-for-alls where they just talk about everything. They're big into haunts. They do a lot of haunted houses. And Brett likes to drink a lot. So what we discovered there is they're a good group of guys. So I thought it'd be cool to bring them on and kind of do a crossover into the podcast world where we talk about Friday the 13th, the original Friday the 13th. I know they haven't covered it yet because I've listened to them, and they just like to jump to like Friday the 13th part 6.
Which we did.
Right. So would you guys like to say anything before we get going?
Just thanks for having us on, man. I'm very excited about this. This is actually our first co-hosting gig with another podcast. So
first collaboration, huh?
First collab.
Yeah. Good movie to start with.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what? It doesn't have to be the last, man. I'd like to do this more often with you guys if you guys want. So anything to help fellow brothers out. So let's jump right into it. Friday the 13th. It was actually, you know, released in 1980. I was 3 years old. So I'm a young one. The director was Sean S. Cunningham. The writer was Victor Miller. The producer was also Sean Cunningham. The composer was Harry Manfredini. And you know that famous, whatever they say, you know what I mean?
I call it the Jason noise.
Right. And I got something in my notes where we talk about it, but I've read two different conflicting things. One of them, it's actually Harry Manfredi's voice slowed down where he was saying something. And the other one is Tom, what's his name? Help me out. Special effects guy, Tom.
Tom Savina.
Savina. I couldn't think of his last name.
Yeah.
Somebody says it's him. So when I get to that in the notes, we'll discuss that. The cinematographer was Barry Abrams. The editor was Bill Frieda. And the casting director was Julia Hughes and Barry Moss. Now, for a horror film, this was riding on the coattails of Halloween. We all know, even Sean Cunningham and them have said that they drew inspiration from Halloween. So you can see some of that throughout this film. But their budget was only $550,000 for this movie. With today's inflation, and it's only going up from here, we both know this, was $1.951 million. So gross worldwide, it made $39,786,892. So it did very well. And with inflation, that would be $141,135,308. So needless to say, I think it was a pretty big hit.
Exactly.
So go ahead.
Started the kind of, again, it, kind of footing off of Halloween, but it sort of started its own subgenre of slasher films, I thought.
Right, right. And we'll get to that in a minute. I can't go ahead and destroy Brett right here in the front with the
not yet.
Versus
not
Jake.
Yet.
We'll get there. But it was released on May 9th in 1980. So a little bit of the technical details before we get into Brett with the casting. It was only a runtime of 95 minutes. The sound mix was mono. It was obviously a color movie. The aspect ratio is 185:1. The camera was a Panavision Panaflex. The laboratory was the Movie Lab in New York. The film length is 2,511 meters. The negative format was 35 millimeter. The process was spherical. And the printed format was 70 millimeter blow-up / 35 millimeters. It did win some awards, or at least were nominated for some awards. I'm not going to go through some of these because some of them are later on when they get like the box sets of all eight of them. I don't really count those. So from 1981, it was nominated for the grand prize for Alvarez Fantastic Film Festival by Sean S. Cunningham. And in 1981, it got nominated for two Razzie Awards. Do you know what the Razzie Awards are?
The Raspberries.
They're basically stinker of movies.
Yeah, so the worst movie.
It was nominated for the worst supporting actress for Betsy Palmer. And it was also nominated for the worst picture for Sean S. Cunningham. But then in 1980, it was also nominated for the best film for MistFest for Sean S. Cunningham. So you had a lot of different people like it. Some didn't like it. I know Siskel and Ebert personally hated this. and I think it was Siskel actually gave out Betsy Palmer's address, and it was the wrong address, telling everybody to, you know, don't hire her and all that. So He made a mistake and actually published the wrong address. So somebody was getting all this hate mail from whoever.
Really? I didn't know that. That's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah, most of this was filmed in New Jersey. Some of the, like the gas station and the cemetery, some of that stuff is still there. I got a little bit more of that in my notes. So, Brett, if you want to go ahead and take away the casting.
All righty. First off, we have, as you said, Betsy Palmer as Mrs. Voorhees, Adrian King as Alice, Harry Crosby as Bill, Janine Taylor as Marcy, Lori Bartram as Brenda, Kevin Footloose Bacon as Jack, Mark Nelson as Ned, Robbie Morgan as Annie, Peter Browers as Steve Christie, Rex Everhart as the truck driver, Ron Carroll as Sergeant Tierney, Walter Gorney as Crazy Ralph, Willie Adams as Barry, Deborah S. Hayes as Claudette, Sally Ann Golden as Sandy, and last but not least, Ari Lehman as young Jason Voorhees.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know he has a metal band?
Who, Jason?
Yep. His metal band's called First Jason.
And that's why he's even better than Michael Myers.
Oh, easy.
Oh,
now.
Wow.
All right. That's about enough of that.
There we go.
All right, Carl. If you were trying to describe this movie to get somebody to watch this movie, what would your synopsis be of what this movie is about?
Well, let's see. I guess, you know, it starts off in 1958 at the Camp Crystal Lake, and you got two camp counselors wanting to go do the naughty stuff together, and somebody kills them. They're dead. So that's sort of an interesting, okay, what just happened? So then you jump ahead, what, about 20 years, and all these kids are trying to get the, they reopen Camp Crystal Lake so they can be camp counselors.
Right. And I think it's also important to know that also a kid had drowned, I think, in 1957.
Oh, we forgot about that. Yeah, that's what Crazy Ralph, I think Ralph tells them a lot of that. You know, there's kid died out there a year before the counselors were all killed.
Right.
So, yeah, we got a drowned young boy and people warned him, don't go out there. That place is cursed.
Yep. I love this movie. I love this whole series, but we'll get to it. Carl mentioned that the little boy drowned, I think, in 1957. While they say that he should have been watched because he couldn't swim very well.
He couldn't swim well.
And I had read somewhere in one of the scripts or something that he was Jason, the boy that drowned was Jason, but they were trying to make him a mongoloid boy. I read something where he had scoliosis. You know, they were just trying to put different things in there, but it never actually comes out and says in the movie why he couldn't swim or anything like that. So, but then now that the camp's being reopened, counselors start getting killed again and you don't know what's going on. So, but Crazy Ralph, he's always there to say you're doomed. You're all going to die.
Basically. You're doomed. It's a curse. Yeah, it's cursed. He's got all kinds of warnings for people.
And you know, at the beginning of this film, what's her name? Is it Annie? The one that's walking. She's the new cook. Is her name Annie, Brett?
I believe so. Yes,
it is Annie.
Yeah. So, you know, she's walking through town and she's just trying to get to Camp Crystal Lake. And she's backpacking. So I don't know where she's backpacking from. You know, she hitchhiked this far and never really says that I remember. So she gets to town and she goes into this restaurant. You know, she's like, hey, can somebody tell me which way is, you know, Camp Crystal Lake? And they're all Camp Blood. You know, everybody just stops. Pee Wee Herman when Large, he says, can somebody tell me about Large Marge? You know, and they're all like, go ahead, Carl. What was he saying?
Oh, just the, you know, they were trying to warn these kids, you know, this place, you don't want to go there. 20 years ago,
yeah,
bad stuff happened. but of course they're not going to listen.
Well, no, the movie would be over.
The movie would be over. Like, oh, well, let's not go to Camp Blood. Let's go there. And then the Paramount logo would come up in the end. Yeah. So, yeah, we got to get them there.
Right. So they asked, I think it was the waitress lady, says, hey, can you, there's a truck driver in there. She says, hey, can you take her, you know, on up down the road? Because it's still quite a while away. And he's like, sure, it's on the way. I can drop you off at a certain point. So she gets in and he starts talking about, you know, you don't want to go there. Have they told you what happened, you know, about the murders and about the boy drowning and all this? And she's like, oh, I'll be okay. I'm just supposed to, he said, have they told you what you're going to be doing there? He's like, she's like, yeah, I'm going to be cooking for 50 kids. So she's the cook. So he drops her off by the cemetery and she starts walking down the road again. Then you flash over to what the counselors and they're all singing. They're all there. No, actually it's Kevin Bacon and the girl and the other guy are driving down to Crystal Lake too in that truck, and they get there and I think Bill's out there chopping wood and he just wants everything painted. He wants everything, you know, he's got a time that everything has to be done. He wants things to get progressed so the camp can get done and ready to go to bring in the campers. So they're still trying to do some work on this, but of course he has to go to town for some more supplies. And so all the counselors are there and they're like, hey, let's go swimming. You know, we're not going to do any work. He's going to be gone for a while. Let's go swimming.
Yeah, the boss is away, so let's play. Yeah.
Yeah, when the boss is away, the mice will play. Right, Brett?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, they decide to go swimming. And you can tell there's a couple of them that are kind of a couple, if you will. And they're still trying to do the naughty things that Carl had mentioned to during his synopsis.
Yeah.
So, Annie's walking again and she gets picked up by this Jeep. And you never see who's driving the Jeep. It's really crazy because the Jeep that Bill owns a Jeep that he's going to town in, and this Jeep that picks her up, it's the same Jeep in the movie. They only use one Jeep for both things. But you never see who's driving the Jeep that picks up Annie. And she starts driving down the road and the Jeep starts going down the road real fast. And they pass the entrance to Camp Crystal Lake. And she's like, hey, you know, you passed there and you can just see her speeding up. Well, this causes Annie to do like a jump out of the Jeep, does a somersault. It looks like she hit her head pretty good, but she was a gymnast. So I guess she knew how to land properly and all that. And she kind of tweaked her leg, if you will. So she starts limping through the forest, you know, running through there because you see the Jeep back up and you don't see, then you just start seeing feet chasing her. And one thing I like about this movie, even at the very beginning, when they kill the two counselors, is you never see the killer. You only see the expression on their face and it goes like that slow motion, you know, at the beginning. Then you had the Friday the 13th pop up there with the glass breaking. I thought that was really well done too. So,
yeah, but I do like the fact that you don't know who the killer is. It is a mystery.
Right.
Because by this point, there is no Jason. You don't see, it's just some mysterious killer.
Right.
So it does make it different than the other Friday the 13th movies.
Mm-hmm. And it makes it different than Halloween, too, because you know Michael was a psychotic lunatic that had killed his sister at a very young age, and he escaped a mental institute. So you knew who the killer was in that. It's just trying to stop him. Here you have no idea what's going on.
No clue. Yeah.
No clue.
And so all you see is those feet walking and then, you know, poor Annie, you know, ends up getting what, a hunting knife to the gut, I think.
Yep.
So the cook is now dead in the forest. So you still
he's going to cook the food.
You still don't know what's going on. So, of course, you know, they go back and the one guy's at the girl's at the archery range trying to fix something, and you see an arrow shoot by. You almost hit her, and it's the crazy, goofy guy out there just acting stupid, which is a lot of foreshadowing of some of the deaths in the movie. If you pay attention, there's a lot of foreshadowing of things that happen. So I don't want to give too much away. I don't want to walk through the whole movie because I think people should watch it. So I'm going to jump to the trivia and hit the most important stuff. But basically, some of these counselors start dying off one by one by one, sometimes by two. But
yeah, sometimes by two.
Pretty gnarly deaths, man. The one that hits me is the Kevin Bacon one with the arrowhead coming through there and twisting.
Yeah.
I got some of the interesting information in my notes about that. So let's just go ahead and jump into there. And then if you haven't seen this movie, please watch it. You know, when I'm thinking outside of the Universal Monsters, because those are my favorite, I think there's really three franchises that you go to. It's Halloween, it's Friday the 13th, and it's Nightmare on Elm Street. When they came out with those three, it basically gained more popularity back into the horror franchises than because it had gone dull, stale there for a minute. What was it after the last horror film? What was the last one, Carl? Do you remember?
Was it
The last Hammer film?
The last Hammer horror film was, I can't think right offhand exactly which one, but I know they did one, the Christopher Lee, where he resurrected the devil's daughter, and it just wasn't a very good movie.
No, but I'm saying that was what, earlier 70s?
Earlier 70s, yeah. Right. Mid 70s, Hammer had pretty much shut down.
Right. So when Michael Myers came out, it was new again. It was fresh.
It was new again.
Right. And so then this coattailed off of Halloween and then Nightmare on Elm Street and all that. So
because we had the whole Exorcist phase coming after that, and everything was about possessions and ghosts. And when Halloween came out, that was sort of the beginning of the slasher film.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole new genre would soon follow.
Right. So, excuse me. For those of you that haven't watched this movie, I'm getting ready to say a lot of spoilers. So let's go ahead. If you haven't watched this movie, turn it off, or I'm going to give away spoilers right here because I'll give you like a little 3 seconds to turn it off because I can't do some of these notes without telling who the killer is. So here we go. We all know that Jason doesn't appear in this movie till the All right, there we are. The curse of Brett has struck the first collab. Why would I expect anything different, right?
Exactly.
I'm just hoping we didn't lose all that audio from the from what we just did for the
good hopefully not
30 minutes or whatever it was. So basically, if that was the break you were needing, so I don't do any spoilers. Jason doesn't even appear in this movie till the very end. The killer is actually Jason's mom, who was a counselor there. She was the cook, in fact. And she's the one that's been going around killing everybody. And what a great death scene she had, off with her head. I mean, it was pretty
good. Yeah, that was definitely some good.
With just a pipe.
Yeah.
It wasn't even anything sharp. It was a dull pipe.
Yeah, she must have swung it pretty hard, man, because it came clean off. So I just wanted to get that out of there before I start going there, because you're going to be like, who's Betsy Palmer? Well, that was Mrs. Voorhees, and then, you know, some of the stuff that we talk about. So Betsy Palmer said that if it were not for the fact that she was in desperate need of a new car, she would have never had accepted the role of Pamela Voorhees. In fact, after she read the script, she called the movie a big piece of what Brett would say. Over the years, however, Palmer did warm up to the film as she became more famous than infamous, and made appearances at conventions and stuff. She would even take pictures with Jason in the hockey mask, you know, as Mama's boy or whatever. So it's just amazing. They don't even say her first name is Pamela. I don't think that comes out until Friday the 13th Part 4, if I remember correctly. There's that. Most of the locations of the set were there. The movie was filmed at Camp Nobe Bosco in New Jersey. The camp is actually still in operation, and it has a wall of Friday the 13th from 1980 memorabilia to honor the movie that was set there. The crew only had to build the bathroom set from the movie. So you take what you get, right? Instead of spending, no wonder they're so low. They just actually, you know, I think they had to make a big donation to the Boy Scouts or the camp or something. To make sure that they got that. But if it's saved on your budget like that, I don't think they would mind. Tom Savini was one of the first crew members on board for the film because the producers idolized his special makeup effects from Dawn of the Dead, which was a great movie. While most of the cast and crew stayed at local hotels during filming, some of the most dedicated, including Tom Savini and Tasso in Stavarikas, stayed at the actual campsite. They had Savini's Betamax VCR and only a couple of movies such as Barbarella and Marathon Man on videotape to keep themselves entertained, so each night they would watch one. To this day, Savini says he can recite those movies by heart.
That's funny.
Yeah, it is.
The Betamax.
Betamax, yeah.
Hey, I've actually watched movies off them before, so.
Well, yeah, Brett, that's because you're old.
That's showing my age.
I remember Betamax, but I remember we had VHS, so I never bought it. I think I saw a Betamax once, and it was, like, huge, and I'm like, what is that?
Yeah, and they were expensive, too, back in the day.
Well, DVD players were expensive, too. I think the first one I got was $400 back then, so, you know.
I think I paid $700 for mine. Yeah. I could not wait.
What was the first movie you got on it?
Actually, I remember it was Lord of Illusions, the Clive Barr movie.
I bought two. I bought Backdraft, and I bought The Fifth Element. So those were
the second one I bought was Brett will like this was Dee Snider's Strangeland, and I still own that DVD because it never came out on Blu-ray. Huh. So I still got it.
Brett, do you remember your first DVDs you bought?
No.
No,
I don't. I don't think I actually had a DVD player until they'd been out a few years. So, yeah, I was still watching VHS probably all the way up until 2000. So
I still got some VHS tapes. I ain't gonna lie. I still got my Star Wars widescreen editions and all that. Filming lasted for 28 days. Now, here's something that the PETA people are not going to like. Do you remember the scene where they go into the one girl goes into the cabin and there's that snake in there? And she, you know, starts yelling for everybody to come in there. So they all come running in there. The one guy's got the machete. It was a real snake. It was actually, they had asked somebody to bring a snake in. So the pet owner didn't know they were going to kill it. They actually chopped it up with that machete, you know, where he cuts it, hits it twice. And they say that the guy started crying on the set because he didn't know that his snake was going to get killed.
His pet snake is dead.
Poor snake.
Oh, well, hey, man, at least he's famous now. You know, the snake's famous.
Snake's a snake.
Yeah, I mean, probably one of the most famous snakes, what, Damien from Jake the Snake Roberts, remember, with Earthquake sat on him and squashed him in the back. That's a wrestling thing. I don't know. I know Brett.
Hey, that's another one of my worlds is wrestling.
Oh, me too. So Brett again, we got to get Brett up to date. So, but the snake scene, it was in the original script and was actually an idea from Tom Savini after he had an experience in his own cabin during the filming. So that was thrown in there because I guess there was a snake in his cabin while they were staying there. Let's see. Willie Adams was a production assistant for the film, and although he spent most of his time behind the camera, he's actually the Mellencamp counselor in the 1958 scene and he has the distinction of being the first person killed in the Friday the 13th film franchise. So it's nice to see when producers and stuff like that actually get a little screen time too.
Little cameo.
Yeah. The working title for the script was a Long Night at Camp Blood. And Victor Miller, as we had talked about, admitted that he purposely was writing this except to John Carpenter's Halloween. So around 19 minutes into the film, the special effects supervisor, Tom Savini, performed the arrow shot that narrowly missed Brenda when she was setting up the archery target. So Savini actually shot that arrow, too. I thought this was interesting, Brett. You'll like this. There's a township named Voorhees in New Jersey, which is only about 8 miles away from Haddonfield, New Jersey. So, which was the inspiration for, of course, Halloween, the fictional town. The documentary Halloween 25 Years of Terror shows a picture of a road sign that lists Voorhees Ride under Haddonfield. The township was named from Foster McGowan Voorhees, the governor of New Jersey from 1899 to 1902. The surname Voorhees is of a Dutch heritage. It is also a common family in New Jersey name. So I thought that was very interesting that not only did they draw inspiration from it, but the township and the city are really close together, too. So.
That is a cool little trivia fact.
Yeah, it is.
Victor Miller wrote the script in only about 2 weeks. And interestingly, Miller never went to summer camp when he was a kid. So very interesting. Did either of you ever go to summer camps when you were kids?
Yeah, I went to the Salvation Army camp when I was a kid.
Carl, did you ever go?
No, I never did. I barely went camping, but like once or twice with my sister. So,
okay, but, you know, there's no woods here in Texas, hardly.
No, we have to go to the lakes if we ever did anything. We have lakes everywhere, and they're all man-made. Yeah. We only have one natural lake in the whole state.
Huh. Is that one that I drove over as I was going through Dallas? Is that man-made or is that real?
It's man-made.
Yeah, they're all man-made around here.
The only one is in East Texas, and it actually goes into Louisiana.
Okay. So I said there was the two Jeeps used in the film were the same Jeep. One is shown with and the other one shown without its soft top on top. So they tried to save money by saying, oh, it's two different Jeeps. But they just took the top off. So
hey, whatever, it worked.
Right. Let's see. The film takes place on July 4th, 1958 and June 13th in the present day. But at no point in the film do they ever mention the year that this has taken place. It just says present day. So I thought that was very interesting, too. Adrienne King's scream was the deal maker when she was auditioning for Alice. So if you can be a scream queen, you've got a role, it seems like. Did you know, I didn't know this either until I was doing these notes, that Harry Crosby is actually the son of Bing Crosby. So he was actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from this movie. So I thought that was pretty
interesting. I think I do remember that part. In passing, I remember it.
Yeah, they say that they had to make a sizable donation to the Boy Scout camp, as we talked about. I couldn't find the actual monetary donation, but I'm sure it was quite big. Yes. So here's that part about the snake. The idea behind the scene where the counselors have to kill a snake they find in one of the cabins was to differentiate the film somewhat from Halloween by having an early fake scare turn out to be legitimate, as well as establish the characters capable of taking action if needed. However, there was no PETA around the film set, meaning they actually took a machete to a real live snake. Allegedly, the owner was standing on the set watching and sobbing when this happened.
So. Poor guy.
Poor snake.
I wonder if he gave him any money, you know, or bought him a new snake or something. I don't know, man. That's terrible.
Yeah, it is.
Because the camp was closed during filming and situated in the deep New Jersey woods, the cast and crew didn't see much outside interference, but it turned out they had a very famous neighbor, rock star Lou Reed, who owned a farm nearby. We got to watch Lou Reed play for free right in front of us while we were making the film, sound man Richard Murphy said. He came by the set and we hung around with each other, and he was just a really great guy.
Huh.
You know who Lou Reed was?
Yep.
Who was?
Oh, I do.
Well, give us a little history lesson on Lou Reed.
It's not my music, so Brett, you'll have to hit the Lou Reed.
He was sort of like a folk singer, sort of maybe. Not quite like Bob Dylan, but he really had his own sound. And then in his later years, he sort of got into like the shock rock stuff too. But so.
Take a Walk on the Wild Side. That's a Lou Reed song.
This is sad to say, but it was the 18th highest grossing film for that year. But you got to remember, it was going up against horror competition films such as The Shining, Dressed to Kill, The Fog, and Prom Night. So there's some good movies there.
Yeah, exactly.
Here you go, Carl. You ready? Stampede Wrestling introduced wrestler Carl Muffet as Jason the Terrible, who wore the hockey mask and was billed from Camp Crystal Lake in the late 80s. The gimmick was later taken up in Japan and Puerto Rico by Roberto Rodriguez and has also been used by Tracy Smothers and many other wrestlers, sometimes using such variation as Jason the 13th.
I do remember that.
So see, Brett, another chalk up to why Jason is better than Michael. We have wrestlers.
All right.
Yeah, there's not a Michael Myers anywhere in wrestling, but yeah, they've had several Jasons in wrestling.
Oh yeah. This was inspired, as we said, by Halloween, but also by the movie Meatballs. Did you ever see the movie Meatballs?
Yes.
So that's where some of the comedy came from. I'm assuming. Because they were trying to get some of the youth market, you know, some of their cash too. So while the Halloween movies have lots of music, the Friday the 13th movies have very little music. In fact, there was a decision made by Harry Manfredini to only have music in the movie when the killer was present. That's why there are only brief, quick moments of music in the beginning, but the climax is wall-to-wall music. So that's a little different than Halloween 2. So I thought that was pretty interesting too. Jason, who, if you say Friday the 13th, most people say, oh, it's Jason, you know, but he's actually not even mentioned by name until 1 hour and 16 minutes into this film. There is a lake located in Pearl, Mississippi called Crystal Lake. Also, this film and the sequels of Friday the 13th, they are said to have take place within the same universe as the Nightmare on Elm Street films, which we got the Freddy versus Jason. Did you guys like that movie?
I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah, didn't we do an episode on it? We did, didn't we?
Not yet.
I don't think we didn't finish. We were going to.
Yeah.
It might have been on the list, and I took it off. We'll put it back on.
Yeah. The thing about that, man, is I was looking for a really good film there, but it turned real comedic real quick. You know what I mean? And I know Freddy's more of a comedic.
Freddy's more comedic, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's why I was like. But I just wish at the end of that, you know, when Jason's walking away with Freddy's head and he winks or whatever, like if you would have seen like Michael Myers or Chucky or somebody else where they could have extended it on, you know what I mean? But trying to get all those monsters into the same universe is probably a PR nightmare.
It is because of the rights.
Right.
Studios, because at the time New Line had actually bought Jason so they could do the Freddy versus Jason movie.
Mm-hmm. And there's a really good fan video of I think it's Jason versus Michael Myers on YouTube, fan made.
I've seen that.
It's really good. The screenwriter Victor Miller's only big problem that he had with this film was that the bumbling cop, you remember the cop that comes and asks what the kids are doing at there, and they're like, hey, we're counselors, and you know, the one guy's out there with a headdress almost naked. Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, he's like, oh
yeah.
He's like, well, we're looking for, you know, crazy Ralph, he's out here thing, you know. He's said to be seen heading this way, and he was, you know, spouting this stuff, and it caused a bunch of PR issues, and we got to take him down and all that, and they release him and all that. But he said he didn't really want to have him in there. And the reason was because they wanted to make the camp secluded where nobody was going to come help them. They were on their own. So they didn't want to say, oh, well, the police are only a short distance away. You know what I mean? That can come help them and save them. They wanted to actually make it where, what are you going to do? It's you versus the killer. And there's the scene, I forget which kill it is, but it shows them stabbing somebody or slicing the throat or something. And you see wearing the, like a suit jacket, which I thought it kind of looked like Ralph. So it kind of threw you for a swerve right there. Cause you thought, well, maybe this is Ralph as the killer. So I thought that was really well done too. So Siskel, he didn't even like Jaws or Alien or even Silence.
He didn't like anything.
And you know, I used to watch him because I was a movie guy and I was like, that movie was good. How can you not say it wasn't good? You know, I don't think I ever agreed with anything they said. So, but they were the ones that got paid the big bucks, I guess. So they were wrong. But I used to love watching them though. Betsy Palmer tells fans she has no idea who this character in the hockey mask is since her son Jason drowned in 1957. You know who Jason is. Adrian King has pictures of FX Tom Savini baking Betsy Palmer's prosthetic head in an oven. So I think that'd be really cool to see. Composer Henry Mifflinetti came up with the now classic attached to the score. And they say it's his voice. And they say that's from, remember where Jason's mom's going, kill her mom, kill her, kill her mom, kill him, kill. You know, they're saying this kill, 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 mom, mom, mom. So that's where the key, mom, mom, mom comes from. So that's what they say it's urban legend is.
I've heard that same thing. It was like killer mommy, killer. And it just went from there.
Yeah. Producer Steve Miner initially thought it was an idiotic idea to bring Jason back for the sequels. He wasn't your villain. He's just a fragment of someone's imagination. However, despite this, he went on to direct the next two Friday the 13th films starring Jason the villain. So
money talks.
Yep. Did you know? I did not know this, but the producers of Friday the 13th, they also produced a Friday the 13th TV show, even though it has nothing to do with the movies whatsoever.
Oh yeah.
Carl's reaching. Does he got it, Carl?
Yeah,
there it he is. Does. The whole series.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. They're going around looking for cursed objects. They have in an antique store, and all these objects got sold off, and they're trying to recollect them all.
How many?
But yeah, it has nothing to do with Jason.
How many seasons was it? Episodes, I guess.
Three or four.
I think it's, let's see if it says on here. I don't even think it tells you on the box. I think it's four.
Is it worth watching?
Oh yeah.
It's pretty dated.
Right.
I enjoyed it. I'll honestly say don't think I've watched the whole series since I bought it on DVD, but I have watched bits and pieces of it.
I'm gonna have to
remember it was three seasons.
Remember the Chiller channel? Did you ever watch the Chiller channel?
Yeah, I had Chiller, yeah.
They played it on there all the time. It was a weekly thing on the Chiller channel. That's where I watched it at.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna check that out. I think that seems pretty good. So Betsy Palmer and the rest of the cast spoke at a Friday the 13th 30th anniversary conference, which was captured in the recent documentary Crystal Lake Memories, The Complete History of Friday the 13th. It's available on YouTube if anybody would like to watch it. At the conference, Palmer said that when she first read the script by Victor Miller, she said, "What a piece of what Brett would say," and threw the script across the room into the trash. Victor Miller, the scriptwriter, was at the conference and heard this comment, and Adriana King patted him on the back consolingly. Palmer said that when she thought about it, she did need the money for a new car, and the movie would probably come and go very quickly, and no one would ever see it, and it would all be quickly forgotten. So she decided to take the job. Little did she know, the movie would become a phenom and would be the main thing she would be remembered for in her career.
That's all I remember her for.
She was kind of annoying in this. there's an old movie. Everybody compares this to Halloween, but there is a old movie from 1945 from Agatha Christie called And Then There Were None. Although technically a detective mystery, it is considered one of the original slasher movies and is very similar structure to Friday the 13th. 10 people isolated in a remote house, a prophecy at the beginning of the story that they will all be killed, and the people are killed off one by one in gory fashion by a mystery killer. The bodies turn up in random places, decorated in hideous ways by the killer to taunt the survivors, until the ending when the final girl faces off against the killer. It was the prototype for other slashers, including Psycho, Halloween, Friday the 13th, and coincidentally, there are 10 victims of both Friday the 13th and There Were None. So I've never seen that movie. I think I need to look for it, though.
So I think we do, too. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds interesting for sure. Yeah.
So
I remember
what that year movie. Did you say that was? 48?
45, I do believe.
45?
Yeah. I remember the movie, but I've never seen it. But I remember it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And Then There Were None is the name of that, if you want to write that down. I think maybe that could be one of our next collabs we do. If we can find copies of it. Agatha Christie.
Actually, yeah, okay. That werewolf movie we did was actually sort of a subgenre from the Agatha Christie book.
She was a good author.
The Beast Must Die. It sort of delved down from there.
Yep. So
we'll try to find that movie.
Yeah, we'll try to do it, and maybe we can get together here in a little bit and do another one.
Yeah.
Steve Miner was the only person that's crossed over from the Friday the 13th films to the Halloween films, having directed both Friday the 13th Part 2 and Halloween H2O. He's also the only person associated with the production to have a character named after him, Steve Christie. Brett. Kevin.
What?
Kevin Bacon shaved his armpits for the bedroom scene, just so you know.
Oh, really? Ooh. Yeah.
Didn't want no greasy bacon. on opening weekend, this film reportedly grossed over 10 times the production cost. So, I mean, it just went crazy. This film is also rumored to have been inspired by the real life Lake Bodom murders in Espoo, Finland on June 5th, 1960. So I'm not familiar with that. I haven't looked at that. So I might have to look that up to see what that was about. Sadly, when you make a film and you're a film star, there are some crazy fans out there that become obsessed with you and stalk you. So that actually happened to Adriana King. She was stalked by an obsessed fan. Terrified, she asked that her role in Part 2 be small as possible. She didn't take any other roles or make convention appearances for almost 20 years after its release because of this.
That's wow. Sad.
And I, if I remember, I think she gets killed off pretty early in part two, right?
I think she does.
But yeah. So, I mean, that's sad, man. You know what I mean? But here you go, Brett. Friday the 13th is the number one entry on the list of horror franchises with the most nude scenes.
Okay.
So Jason's got Michael there, too. Here's another one. Now, this is going to be interesting, and I'm going to see if I can find it. But there is a podcast by Quantum Recast, I think is the name, took Friday the 13th out of 1980 and recast it into the year of 2005 with relevant actors from that year. In Friday the 13th, 2005, Jason goes to Disney World.
Oh, no.
Oh.
It's got to be good, I have to say.
So it was like a fan film or?
No, it's a podcast.
Oh, it's a podcast?
I wonder if it's a, like an audio drama. Like
an audio drama, oh, it sounds okay. Like.
Yeah.
I'm or an audio comedy in this case, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Website Mr. Skin posted the top 10 horror franchises with the most female nude scenes. Lists includes Witchcraft, which has 77. Friday the 13th has 49. Hellraiser has 24. Wrong Turn 17. Piranha 16. Hostel 14. Silent Night, Deadly Night 14. Halloween 14. And Amityville 9. So there's another sad fact about the snake getting killed. During the first few weekends of the film's release, makeup and special effects artist Tom Savini would go into theaters for the last 5 minutes of the show to see the audience react to Jason emerging from the lake and grabbing Alice. So he went a little undercover. People can't do that anymore because you're too famous. With all the social media now, they're going to know who you are.
Yeah, they'd go Facebook Live on you immediately.
Yeah, look who's in here.
Yeah.
Tom Savini actually doubles for Brenda in the shot in which her body is thrown through the window. If you remember where she's dead and they've got her like the board wrapped around her and the rope all around her. The body count is 11, which is including the real snake. RIP snake. In the scene where Bill is found impaled to the door with Arrow, his eye twitches continually because the eye effect that Tom Savini applied was actually burning Harry Crosby's eye and causing him excruciating pain. So
I bet.
We talked about that kill, 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 cha-cha-cha. Betsy Palmer only worked on the film for 10 days, for which she received $1,000 per day. In 1980, that's pretty good money.
That got her a good car.
Yeah, it did.
Years before the film was ever conceived, Betsy Palmer spent her summers growing up on Crystal Lake in Warsaw, Indiana. So that's not too far from here. Okay, so here's the probably my favorite death scene where that arrowhead comes through. I told you I had something special with the arrowhead come through. So for his death scene, Kevin Bacon had to crouch under the bed and insert his head through a hole in the mattress. Then a latex neck and chest appliance was attached to give the appearance that he was actually laying down. Getting the setup to look right took several hours, and Bacon had to stay in that uncomfortable position the entire time. For the bloody final moment, Tom Savini, also under the bed, would plunge the arrow up and through the fake neck, while his assistant, also under the bed, operated a pump that would make the fake blood flow up through the appliance. To further complicate things, the crew needed someone else to stand in for the killer's hand as it held Kevin Bacon's head down, and they settled on still photographer Richard Fury. So after several hours of setup and latex building and planning, it was finally time to shoot the scene. And when the moment of truth came, the hose for the blood pump disconnected, knowing that he basically only had one take. Otherwise, they'd have to build the whole new latex appliance and set up everything all again. Tasso and Starficus grabbed the hose and blew into it until the blood flowed out, saving the scene. He said, "I had to think quickly, so I just grabbed the hose and blew like crazy, thankfully causing a serendipitous arterial blood spray. The blood didn't taste that bad either." But, you know, how long would that have taken to set up and then...
Oh, yeah.
You ruin it because the blood didn't come out because you can't just CGI that stuff in back then either.
Not then.
No.
Not on the budget they had.
Especially. Have you seen the Tom Savini documentary that he went on about that, saying that's one of the hardest scenes he's ever done in a movie?
I haven't watched that, but wasn't that on Shudder?
Yeah, I think it's on Shudder. Yeah,
I might have to check that out. I have Shudder. So there's a lot of good documentary stuff like that, too. So Betsy Palmer insisted that Sean Cunningham put her in the beginning of the movie at the diner or waving to Annie on the road as she is hitchhiking to Crystal Lake. He didn't take her advice. And I think that would have been really cool to have her in the diner at the beginning, you know, where they're all talking about don't go to Crystal Lake and all that. Or I don't know about waving as she's hitchhiking.
Yeah, that would have been weird.
But have her in the diner scene, you would have never even known her.
And yep, exactly. Sitting there drinking a cup of coffee or something.
You could have had a small flashback, you know, back at the diner where they say, hey, stay away from, you know, Camp Crystal Lake and just have her sitting there drinking in the background or something. You know what I mean? I think it would have been cool, but he's like, nah, they wanted to, I guess, shift to Ralph or whoever, you know, because they didn't want you to know who the killer was. Victor Miller admits he was subconsciously inverting the psycho formula, where instead of the son having a split personality and pretending to be the mother, we have the mother pretending to be the son. So I thought that was pretty cool, too. We already talked about that too. And last but not least, Kevin Bacon claims that he asked to sign screenshots from his death scene in this movie more than any other movie he has been in. So I think that's pretty interesting. So we'll start with Carl, and then we'll go around. We'll let Brett go after him, and then I'll go to finish it up. So Carl, what's your thoughts and feelings on Friday the 13th, the original?
Well, definitely groundbreaking, although it was inspired by Halloween. It special place for me. It's always seemed to forget at times that Jason wasn't it until the very end. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy the movie a lot, and I'd give it a 4, whatever me and Brett call them.
Devil horns.
Yeah. Yeah, I just give, you know, just it had a few moments that, but yeah, it's definitely 4-star movie.
Brett?
Well, I seen this when it first came out in 1980. I was 13. Actually, my mom took me seeing it, but she went and seen a different movie, and I went and seen it. And yeah, I love this movie. Especially the end when he jumps up on the boat, man, that scared the crap out of me.
When you were in the movie theater by yourself?
Yeah, creepy moment.
Just the way he did it, you know. Did that a few times. Sometimes my mom was a big horror fan, but sometimes she didn't want to see some of the stuff I wanted to see, so I had to go by myself.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it's a good movie. I'm grateful that it helped carry on the legacy of horror franchises, because I think there were so many things that came out after this that could revert back to Halloween and this. If you put this movie up against Halloween or even the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, those, I'm going to say, standalone films, Halloween and Texas Chainsaw Massacre will beat it every time. However, what I will say is I think that the Friday the 13th series as a whole is better and more concise throughout all of them than Halloween, where you have to have a pie chart and all this to follow the storylines. You got multiple universes of Michael Myers. And I think,
exactly.
I think the Jason one flows a lot better. It gels together a lot better. So definitely I like this movie. If we're going 4 out of 5, I'd have to agree with Carl. If we're going 10, it's probably an 8 or 9 out of 10 for me, because it kickstarted the franchise that I love, because Jason is my favorite. I know Michael is yours. But I'm just glad that we had this opportunity to have more scares in your life. You know what I mean? Because if you walk into, let's say, your local haunted house or your local, spirit Halloween or whatever it is down there or everywhere, you go in there, you're definitely going to see the Freddies, you're going to see the Jasons, and you're going to see the Michael Myers, you know, and you'll see some of the old Universal monsters too, but, and you'll see Chucky and all them. But, you know, what do you think, or do you think that we will ever have another run like from 77? Was it 77 when Halloween came out?
78.
To Nightmare on Elm Street and Jason, do you think we will ever have another run of new material or new monsters created that can continue the process going forward? Or do you think that this was as good as it's going to get?
It would be nice to have something new.
Right.
For sure.
Well, I mean, you know what Halloween Ends or whatever's getting ready to come out, either later mm-hmm. this year or next year, right? I think a lot of times they try to just capitalize on what they already have instead of that's my biggest problem with Hollywood. They all want to do these remakes and nobody wants to think for themselves and come up with new stuff. And yes, you'll make your money, maybe make your money back in a little bit more by either remaking or continuing the franchise, as we've seen with
relaunching.
Right. I just wish they could come up with other stuff. I thought Trick or Treat was pretty good with Sam, the Halloween boy. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, we have a Sam in the corner over here, actually.
I see him back there. But yeah. I don't know. I wish there would be something else, but I don't know if there's going to be.
I don't think so. The Saw movies may have been the closest thing that we'll ever have gotten to.
Right.
Because they'd done a really good job with Saw, and then it finally fiddled out.
I know they're trying with the Conjuring universe, with the Nun and all that, with Ed and Lorraine Warren, but it's just not the same.
Yeah, it's getting not. Old.
Right.
So. They tried with the Hatchet movies too, but them sort of got cheesy.
Right.
They weren't really big releases either. The Saws were pretty big. The Conjuring universe, it just seems to have gotten pretty stale pretty quick. Right. I think after about the second Annabelle movie, it was sort of just like, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I agree too. And you know, I know they tried with the Dark Universal Monsters with Tom Cruise, The Mummy.
Yeah, that was.
They dropped the ball. They should have, that Dracula, whatever they called it.
Dracula Reborn or whatever.
That they should have made that like the beginning of the new Universal Dark Universe, because I thought that was a strong movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that Tom Cruise Mummy was just not a way to start something.
I'd rather have the Brandon Fraser Mummy be the starting point if they were going that route. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was exactly.
More Indiana Jones than horror movie. So
right.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thanks for coming on. Brett, why don't you let everybody know where they can reach you?
Well, you can get us on all the social medias, Evil Never Dies podcast. Email is evilneverdiespod@gmail.com.
Don't forget your TikTok.
TikTok, it's at Evil Never Dies. Twitter is at
Weird
Evil NVR Dies.
I know you're pretty upset about that because somebody
took it. Yeah, I was pretty mad somebody took it. So, but websites, www.evilneverdiespod.com. That's about it.
And they can find you.
Check us out.
They can find you anywhere that the like iTunes and Apple
Podcasts. Yeah, we're on everything.
Okay.
All the platforms.
Carl, why don't you tell anybody listening that might be in the area that hasn't heard of you guys about your haunt and that you guys are looking for actors for your haunt for the Halloween weekend or whatever?
Yes, I'm back to after 10 years doing our backyard haunt, which is, I have a huge backyard, so it's just not some, you know, one room thing. Information on that, you can go to www.countkarabi.com, which will take you to our Facebook page and give you all the information about that, or just go to Facebook and search for Count Karabi's Museum and all of our info's there.
You said you're looking for actors?
Yeah, we're always looking for something. Yeah.
So
actors, looking for people to come through it, you know.
And you guys aren't? Go ahead.
This is sort of our relaunch year. Last year was sort of a test, so we're hoping to get a whole lot more people come through this year. So.
And you are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, correct?
Yes, we are.
Fort Worth,
close to downtown Fort Worth, actually.
Yeah, I just went down there for WrestleMania, and I actually went out to eat with Brett. So,
yeah, we had a good time, man.
Good time. So, as always, you guys can find us at the Tragedy of Cinema podcast on Facebook group. We have a lot of fun on there. The Evil Never Dies podcast has a group on there. If you like what you heard, go ahead and go leave The Evil Never Dies a nice review and rating. Help them guys out. If you're into heavy metal, rock and roll, haunted house stories, or just listening to Brett complain about how much the price of limes have gone up at Walmart. Go check them out. I mean, I listen to you guys because I have a 2-hour drive back and forth to work. I listen to you guys every Monday morning on the way home. So you guys help me keep me entertained and awake on the road. So I appreciate it.
We appreciate, well,
we appreciate you, man. Thanks for having us on.
No problem. So what I like to do when I end my things, my podcast, is I'll say, hey, you know, that's the episode's coming to close and that's a wrap. And then I'll go and cut. And we end it.